Welcome to the Wedding Guest Extraordinaire podcast with me, Sarah Southern. Join me each week as I talk everything weddings, taking you from engagement to honeymoon, making sure that you really do enjoy planning your big day. Welcome to this week's episode of Wedding Guest Extraordinaire. I'm your host, Sarah Southern. This week, we're joined by a very special guest, my very, very dear friend, Elliot. He married his husband in the summer of 2016, and I was very delighted to be a part of that wedding. We had a lovely conversation about his wedding, his engagement, making sure all the guests had a perfect time, dealing with parents, picking where to get married, and also some of the pitfalls of having a gay wedding when you are in fact quite a religious couple and can't get married in church, and making that service seem really, really special. Anyway, I won't give too much more away. We'll just dive in straight into the interview. I do hope you enjoy it. Hi, Elliot. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Sarah. How are you?
Very well. Thank you very much for coming along and joining me.
No, thank you for inviting me and the glass of red wine.
Well, I like to be a good host. I like to be a good host. Now, tell me, when did you get married?
We got married in the, I'm now forgetting, July of 2016.
Correct. And who is it that you married?
I married my lovely husband, Tom.
Ooh, congratulations on
Thank
that.
Thank you.
I obviously was there.
You were.
So I would like to start, if I might please, with the proposal. Because I remember when there was a time where you didn't think you would get married and
No.
you weren't that keen potentially on gay marriage, which we will talk about in a little while. But I was just wondering if you could tell me about why you decided to propose and how you proposed.
Why did Wow, that's quite personal for a starting question.
You don't have to answer.
No, I do. There's two things I remember. Is that one, I had to propose twice. And that I know that it was left to me to propose because of that very point that Tom was like, it has to be you because you're the one who has the most issue with two men getting married. Get over it. What's wrong with you? It's the 21st century.
Because Tom was very pro-gay marriage,
totally,
wasn't he?
Yeah, very much so.
You just took a little bit longer to warm up to it.
It was one of those things where it's all in that sort of whole myth of the coming out and being a gay of a certain age and just assuming things about your life. And then you do meet someone who is amazing and wows you and deals with the fact I have the most erratic, chaotic working lifestyle. And he just was, apart from throwing a crit set at me when I said I was moving to Iraq, he was fine with everything. And it was just amazing to find someone who was so supportive. And so I was... Do you want the whole story?
Well, should I kind of fill in some gaps?
Fill in some gaps.
Because obviously I was there from the first date through to the first
That is true. I feel like you could just give a monologue. But I don't really, you know this.
Obviously, when you and Tom got together, he was a teacher. So he was living outside of London. You were living in London. You then got this amazing opportunity to go and work in Iraq for about 2 years.
Yeah.
So you then did this rather peculiar long-distance relationship that often involved Tom meeting you at Heathrow Airport with lots of pork products because you hadn't been able to get your bacon satisfaction in Iraq. But I do, and I hope you don't mind me sharing this, but I do remember when it was about a month before you were going to propose to Tom and you said to me, I'm going to do it.
Well, that was the downside of living abroad. And also there was the weird sort of setup of I was supposed to fly from Iraq to meet him on holiday in France and then go back again. So I'd had to think, I want to do this while we're in France. So I have to get the gift I wanted to get him to propose with way in advance and then carry it around with me, including to Iraq and back again. But then once I was out in Iraq with the gift ready to fly back, ISIS happened and we were evacuated from Iraq. And it all just became this chaotic melange of a story.
Do you know what? I had actually forgotten about that.
So I arrived in France with Tom paranoid about the fact that I was going to be killed by either American bombing or ISIS. And actually, I was really blasé about it, going, it's fine, stop worrying about
it. That was a very stressful time, as I do remember you kind of texting me what your location was and asking me to look online to see if there are any flights to get you out of the airport that you were trying to drive towards. And I was also watching the news and seeing where the insurgents were and thinking, that seems jolly close.
Yeah,
and so later admitted it was incredibly close.
It was, and it's one of those things where at the time you don't think about it, but it is just interesting to think that the watch that I eventually proposed to them has had its own adventure. And went to Iraq before Tom did, even though he's now been with me to see that actually it's all
quite safe.
Interesting and safe. But yeah.
So you carry this watch, we have now learned, so you didn't use a ring.
No.
Around with you. So you talk us through the evening or daytime that you then proposed to Tom.
We had been on holiday with friends in the south of France and we were driving back up to his parents who live in Brittany. And we stopped at a really nice hotel with a Michelin-starred restaurant. The pretense of being, it was our anniversary of our first date. And so Tom had got a gift for me, which was a lovely little sort of Mont Blanc pen. And then I fumbled the proposal by sort of being really British and male about it and going, and throwing a watch at him. And he was like, oh, this is amazing. And he opened the watch, and obviously a watch is quite a considerable gift. And he was like, so just clarifying. And I said, well, I'm proposing. He was like, why are you not on one knee?
Is that what he said?
Yes. So I got down on one knee. And for some reason, I felt phenomenally self-conscious about it. Even though I had spent time with the waiter clearing the patio because there was a really noisy man at one end. And I was just like, you need to move him. He's really inconvenient for the ambiance I'm trying to create. And it was the sun was setting over the Bordeaux region. It was really beautiful. But I just felt really nervous. It's a really... For any men who have proposed, any women who have proposed, anyone who's proposed, I think you will know that it's just a phenomenally nerve-wracking thing. And I don't know why it is. Because I knew he would say yes. There wasn't a doubt. I knew it was the right thing, but you just have that nervousness that, I don't know, it's the start of a life-changing decision. And it's, other than sort of buying a car or a house, it's like a really grown-up thing to do. And sometimes you have to remind yourself you are a grown-up, but it was, yeah, phenomenal. And he said yes, and it was beautiful. And
well, one of the things that always surprises me is the fact that you did have that watch on you for so many weeks. And I'd have to admit, out of all of my friends, I think you're the one who's worst at keeping secrets.
It was impossible.
Yeah, so the fact that you didn't, like the first 3 seconds that you saw Tom go, oh, by the way, I'm going to propose.
The hardest thing was being on holiday with sort of 8 of our best friends in the south of France and not telling any of them. I don't think I did anyway. I think there were 3 people who knew. In hindsight, I would have told my parents beforehand. They were quite shocked, and they were more shocked about the fact it would have been good to have a heads up that you were going to do this. But you know, my parents like to know everything ahead of time anyway. Yeah, they're not huge surprise people.
Have you told them you're here tonight?
Oh God, no. They'll find a link to this one day and be like, what?
No, I think it's really lovely how much effort and how special you wanted to make it, because you had this, you know, incredibly intense romance when you first met Tom.
Yeah.
And then you were separated, you know, kind of Romeo and Juliet style, you know, you being in Erbil, him being in the Cotswolds. You know, it was this kind of unusual romance. And you knew quite early on.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying to me within the first few months, he's absolutely who I want to be with forever.
I think there's one of those challenges where I'm going to sort of make a huge generalisation and not having had many relationships before, but I do think if you have a long-distance relationship and you can make it work, that is a special thing. It takes considerable effort. I mean, modern technology is a wonder and makes it so much easier, but it is tricky, and you do have to constantly think about the other person. And it comes, but it'll come at really inconvenient moments. Like you'll be at lunch with colleagues and you think, oh, this would be really good. Tom would love this. But that you can't just ring him then because he's teaching or you've got meetings. And then later in the day, you'll be busy cooking dinner and you'll think, oh, I must ring Tom. And it's a really odd thing to sort of constantly be thinking of someone. But luckily, Tom's really good at writing love letters and hiding them in bags and
oh, crumbs, I'd forgotten things. About that. And he would do sweet really, things, wouldn't he?
Yeah, sweet, romantic, soppy.
All the things you're not.
but that's part of what makes him so amazing.
And I think that's what makes your relationship work, because you are different in that way. You know, you bring different strengths and weaknesses to the table. So you've
thanks, friend.
Pleasure. So you've got him to agree. You've got that watch on the wrist.
Yes.
How do you then start planning the big day? What's the first thing you decide? I guess you grew up in Warwickshire. Tom grew up in Gloucestershire. How do you decide which location? Oh, and you live in London. How do you decide which location?
How did we do that? I don't remember how we did that. We just started talking and we started looking.
Because I think there was a period of time where you were quite keen on a London venue.
We explored it, but if being very frank at the outset, it's really expensive.
Yeah.
And it's a very different kind of thing doing a London wedding, I think, because so many of the people we know are from London. Excuse me. But so many of our family aren't. So you kind of think, well, what do we do? And then either which way you do it, people have to travel. But travelling out of London is a darn sight cheaper than travelling into London, even though people from London always moan about it. But they secretly love it. We know that, I think.
I wouldn't go that far.
I think our original idea was to try and do somewhere equidistant between mum and dad and Tom's parents. But we just started looking for venues, and we just started emailing and Googling, and Tom was very good at reading all the websites and the magazines and trying to understand, like, what are the venues? And it really did come down to the idea of a rough idea of date, although we ended up not actually following that, and a rough idea of where, and you try and make the two marry.
As I guess this is what is quite interesting about a gay wedding, is there is certain conventions when a man and a woman marry, because more often than not, the woman has more control over the location because they might want to get married in their home parish.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't have that with two men. There isn't one who's more in control than the other when it comes to the big day, perhaps.
I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, because I think more and more these days, I don't think the distinction is as obvious, because there's so much more of people getting married slightly older, much more of people making the decision together. And I think that's one of the things that freed us up, is that we could just get on and do what we wanted to do. There weren't any preconditions about who thought what might happen. And so I think that did free you up from the very beginning. I mean, we had the other extreme of our parents going, well, are you going to involve us?
Yeah, I do remember having lots of chats with you about how to kind of navigate the tough diplomacy of dealing with both sets of parents, because they both wanted to be involved. Yeah. And not in a negative way, just in a how can you manage that? Because there's no way this day is going to happen if everybody is involved. It's going to be too much.
I think it was quite clear to everyone quite early on that Tom and I knew what we wanted this day to look and feel and be. We had that obvious bizarre thing of it wanting to be religious but not being able to get married in church, because churches don't do that. We'll move on. And it was a case of, well, we need a venue that can enable us to have a good ceremony, but also actually let's have everyone in the same place. And actually, you mentioned the London venue earlier, and that was ruled out quite quickly, because you can't really do that so easily in London unless you want like a massive hotel, and they're just astronomical. And so actually what we were looking for then is somewhere in the country which could do both. But I was absolutely 100% convinced I was not having a marquee.
I can understand that.
Which is, having worked in events for periods of my life as well, marquees remind me of conferences and, you know, in the height of summer they have that smell and it just reminds me of work. And I was just like, I don't want that. I want a venue that can host us in buildings or sort of things that aren't a marquee.
And I do think that's really important when you are choosing your venue, to have your firm no's, because it makes everything easier. If having a marquee is a firm no, that rules so many things out, therefore you can make a more sensible decision on what you do have available. Now, I do want to just ask you a little bit more about the religious element, because both you and Tom are practicing Christians. You are very good Christians in that you go to church most Sundays, but you are unable to get married in a church because the Church of England don't allow that for gay couples. So how did you kind of come to terms with that? Because I know that you wanted your marriage to be blessed in the eyes of God, but obviously legally you're unable to do that. Was that something that was quite difficult to come to terms with?
It was something I think that was harder for me to come to terms with than it was for Tom. Tom's very comfortable in his faith and who he is and that side of it. I sometimes have struggled with that a little bit more. But what was quite good is that we knew that we wanted to do that. And so it was a case of saying, well, we know from having friends who are in different stages in the church and different parts of the church, in both the Roman Catholic and the Anglican Church, that there are varying views and we can kind of make something work. But we're also very aware of the fact it wouldn't be a marriage, it'd be a blessing of a marriage. And you sort of just get used to what is possible and you make what is possible fit with the day. But you also, one of the things that's quite refreshing is, because it's not in church with set liturgy, when this is the way the church does it, we had some flexibility to think, well, actually, how do we want to reflect our faith in the service as well.
And I thought what was really lovely on your wedding day is you had the legal ceremony just with your immediate family in a anteroom, for want of a better phrase. And then the main room.
In the side room.
Yeah, in the main room, which actually looked a bit church-esque.
Yeah,
and it had a very high ceiling and it had beautiful windows.
Really out of tune piano.
Very out of tune piano. And the way that we'd laid out the chairs, you know, it had that feel. And because obviously it was a blessing, you could have hymns. And you were very fortunate in that a family friend who has been a vicar or a chaplain in the past. Was able to do that blessing for you. So to all intents and purposes, everyone who turned up thought that was you getting married.
Well, that was the thing. We know we had to get legally married and civil partnered. That's right. Civilly married. Sorry.
Yes,
getting the terminology right. And it actually was really frustrating that you can't have any religious references in that. I think that's really odd. In this day and age when everything's a bit blurred anyway and people sing hymns but don't necessarily have the meaning, it seems odd. But by the by, and then we wanted the big ceremony with all our friends to be the central part. Just because I always think it's a bit odd if you do have those two bits that you've kind of had two weddings. And
well, also, speaking from the point of view of a guest...
here we go.
I think it is a little odd if most people who have been invited then find out they've not been invited to the main bit.
Well, that's why it had to be the main bit.
Yeah.
And also, it made it a very easy decision that for the civil wedding, it was just going to be family. Because then you don't have that. You have to have witnesses and you have to have your family for that bit. Let's be realistic. But the big, the main event, as it were, the showpiece was the blessing. And we wanted to put the effort and energy and thinking into that. The civil side is handled by the registrar. The event in the hall was handled by us and designed by us to reflect us.
And it's pretty spectacular. I mean, you had an opera singer.
We did. She's amazing.
Sing something pretty special. So, you know, you were lucky that you've got a friend who just happens to be a very talented opera singer.
But you mentioned the vicar earlier as well. And we were very lucky that we had friends for all bits of it. So one of Tom's old family friends played the piano. Bless his socks, it was outrageous. But he also could just pick up and help a friend of ours who was an opera singer who absolutely wowed everybody. It was fantastic. And, you know, the priest was a friend as well. So it all fit together quite nicely and we had people to support us to make the event what we wanted it to be.
And I think the guests very much enjoyed that.
Well, the singing would imply they did. It was very good singing.
So I guess at this stage we should let our listeners know what role I had in your wedding, because at the time of the planning of Tom and Elliot's wedding, I was living with Elliot in his flat whilst he was living in Iraq. So I kind of had a front row view of all the planning.
And a guiding hand.
A guiding hand. That is a very diplomatic way of putting it. So who
might be less diplomatic?
Who was in your wedding party?
We ended up having quite a few people, and I'm going to forget people if I try and list everybody. So I think it's a case of saying we had our... my sister and Tom's brother were our witnesses. Our mothers walked us down the aisle. Our fathers gave speeches. We had a cohort of good friends who were ushers or who did some readings and prayers. And then there was Sarah.
So what was my role, Elliot?
So you were chief usher / director of guest experience.
I like to put it the other way around. I like to say I was the director of guest experience / chief usher.
But I love the fact we got to give you that title because it was your mantra through the whole thing and also your guiding principle.
Well, when we were discussing points of the wedding, often you and Tom would say utterly ridiculous things. And I would just put my head in my hands and be like, you don't need to do that. What benefit is that going to do? And I would always say, just think of the guest experience.
Yes.
Because there is no point having a wedding and inviting all those people if you're not thinking about the guest. You may as well just have your own private wedding.
I think that's very true. And actually, it was a really good thing to do because you go to weddings since and you can tell it's not necessarily the couple who don't always think that through. It can be the venue who are just thinking, actually, we've got this pro forma way we do this. We're going to move you through our conveyor belt. But also, you as a couple want to put your stamp on it, and then you're meddling with the way the venue does it, and then it falls out of sync, and the guests get left standing around for 3 hours with a glass of warm wine in their hands, and you know, that isn't necessarily anyone's fault. It's just that someone hasn't quite connected dots of, well, actually, if we're going to do all the photos now, that's going to cause a time delay. How do we ensure? Blah, 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 blah. And you were very good at going, but think that through a second. Does that work? What are you doing? Don't do that. That's ridiculous.
I think
a whole host of different options.
At times, Tom was a bit like, and why has Sarah got such a vocal voice at the wedding planning table? She's not actually getting married.
Yeah, but you and I work together in events as well. So, we both know that you just get shit done.
But also, I knew you could take it. I knew you could take my brutal criticism.
But I think that's one of the things that I quite liked and quite found refreshing, is that as a couple, Tom and I were getting engrossed in these great ideas of things we would do, because wouldn't it be magical if, and then you would come along and go, no.
I do remember you coming up with an idea for the party favours, and me saying,
Are you making this public? Or are you just,
and I said, do you want to do the maths on that? I said, just calculate how much that's going to cost. And it came out as something insane, like £5,000. And I was like, what are you doing? Get a grip. No one wants these things. They're going to get thrown away.
Yeah.
Like, can you just both calm down? And I think you were then both a bit like, okay, well, we'll find an alternative to that.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the things that happens, is you just start looking and you get carried away and you just want it to be the best day and you throw everything at it, and then you've got to compromise, and there's reality, and there's, well, actually, you know, what do people care about at these things? We want it to be great for us, but once you've had the ceremony and the party's underway, it's all about you two. So actually, you're going to have a great day, but you also need to make sure that, you know, your elderly relatives and your friends who you kind of know, and bits of family from over here, and also have a great day, because there are going to be people there who only know one or two other people. And you were right to sort of say, actually, how does this all fit together?
And I do think one of the lovely things about your wedding is it was very inclusive. The day ran really well. Immediately after the service, everyone lined up and, you know...
Did that happen automatically? It's amazing how people just magically do that, isn't it, Sarah?
How these things happen. And people ran out, and you've got all these beautiful photographs of people throwing petals. And these were things that you'd obviously discussed with the photographer, and you're like, this needs to happen. How can we have this? And then we had a beautiful champagne reception. There were then some speeches by your father and by Tom's father, which was really nice, before we then went into dinner. And what was so lovely about the venue that you chose, that I can't remember the name of.
Elmore Court.
And I will put a link to that in the show notes, because if you're thinking of getting married, go and speak to the people.
Definitely.
At Elmore Court. They were so wonderfully helpful.
Yeah.
From the moment we arrived to the moment we left, they were absolutely brilliant, weren't they?
They were. And the thing that... Actually, it was actually the... I have now, of course, completely forgotten the lady's name who helped us on the day. I was remembering earlier. And
I think
now
I've still got her mobile number in my phone.
But the venue staff as a whole were just brilliant. And that's one of the things that made us think, actually, we want to do this here. A, the venue is stunning. It's, as Tom would say, on the wrong side of Gloucester. But, you know...
I didn't know there was a right side of Gloucester,
well,
but okay.
It's a local thing, I think. But the venue staff just were like, well, it's all about you, and you need to make sure it works for you, and how do you want this to work? And we said, well, what is it you do? And they said, well, this is the space. What do you want to do with it? And it was so refreshing. And I know that, really, in the reality of it, if you go back and look at it, we didn't do anything revolutionary. The order was fairly similar. But what they helped us do was make sure it ran how we wanted to run, to our times. And
I would agree you didn't necessarily do anything revolutionary, but you didn't have to. But what you did do is you delivered everything beautifully. So you did what I absolutely love at weddings, where it's long tables instead of round tables. There were four really long tables. Therefore, everybody feels in it. And you also did the thing that I really like, is you put people who are on the wedding party on the very ends of the back tables. Because you're already, like, I'm involved enough. Like, I don't need to be further in. Neither did Pete or any of the other ushers. Therefore, we were kind of on the periphery. Therefore, all the guests who were sat near us were like, oh, well, I must be reasonably important if I'm sat next to the wedding party. Because it does feel weird when you go to a wedding and you're sat on a table that's way out the back and you're thinking, did they actually want me here? And that's a good way of dealing with it.
But there's a little bit of people overthinking that. And yes, there is, when you're putting the table plan together, you do think, oh, who's near, what? We're on a table of family, because with Tom has a lot of family and I've got some family, and, you know, it takes up the space. But I, we wanted to do long tables because that's the way the venue did it well. And obviously, again, having worked in events, round tables have a connotation. I think round tables are great if you can be sure of how your friendship splits up and make sure that no one feels left out. And it works really well in a lot of venues for moving round. Long tables are quite hard to move between, actually, in hindsight. But they do create a kind of party atmosphere. It's a little bit more, as the day goes on, it's a little bit more Oktoberfest. It's a little bit more...
I do remember there being a few drinking games on one table, I think.
Tom's friends.
Oh, right. As pudding was being served, yeah, there seemed to be
I don't think my friends need assistance.
Well, it's because your wedding favour ended up being gin that you and Tom
just
had
neat
got
gin.
Made. So people were just necking that, which is perhaps why...
Neat gin and my father-in-law's homemade wine.
Maybe that's why Pete thought he was going to die the next day. Pete is is Elliot's friend who helped me organise the stag do and was also the MC for the day. And he's a big chap. I'm hoping that he'll come on to the podcast and talk about his wedding to Hannah.
Oh, you should. It was an amazing wedding. Yeah, that's a good one.
And I don't think I've ever seen anyone so hungover in my entire life.
No, I don't think I've seen him hungover. on an aside, when... at his wedding the next morning, he was so sprightly, and I was like, wow, okay.
this is what love does to
you. Clearly, if you're the groom, you don't get quite as drunk as if you're not. We won't talk about my sister's wedding.
Yeah, I was pretty hungover after that one as well. So we had a beautiful dinner. I thought the food was really, really great at Elmore Court.
Amazing.
Really great.
Amazing food.
Now, when was the first dance? Was the first dance immediately after dinner?
Oh, now that's too much detail. I can't
remember.
We had a first dance.
There was a band. There was a disco.
Yeah.
There was lots of chaos. It felt like there was lots of chaos.
See, well, that's one of the things I find quite odd is you go into dinner... I mean, we'll come to the errors of don't be the grooms who do the speech after dinner because you're drunk and it doesn't quite work.
Didn't you lose your notes?
Yeah.
Let's gloss over that one.
I don't want that one recorded, thank you. I think there was speeches and then cake and then dancing. But it was certainly sort of early evening by that point, so lots must have gone on in between the... Well, going in for dinner and the dancing.
By that stage, I don't even think I'd had that much to drink because I still had a clipboard in my hand.
Why do you not have a clipboard in your hand?
I did put it down at some point. I do remember your mum walking up to me at one point and grabbing it out of my hand and said, for God's sake, it can't be in every single photograph. And she, like, really berated me. And I was like, oh, well, I'll take my earpiece out.
But actually, there's one thing I was going to say earlier that the clipboard has reminded me of, and I don't think people think that through enough, because if you're the bride and groom or the groom and groom or the bride and bride, and you spent a lot of time organising the wedding, but actually where you came in really handy is, and Pete as well as the MC, were your friends who know what we want to do and who the venue know to go to. So actually, as Tom and I, we were just sort of gently wafted through the day. Once we, you know, said our vows, had the blessing, run through, and it just kept going.
Yeah, I didn't stop working until the band started.
Someone has to.
Someone, like, needed to go and see their child that was in one of the rooms in the house. Like, but you know, you're just like, well, I don't know where the nanny is.
But it's amazing. And we know this from working in events, that you know during the course of an event, in order to keep it running smoothly, it doesn't matter how good the venue are or how well prepared the people at the venue are, they're going to need decisions being made. And I don't want to be taking those decisions when I'm, you know, panicking about my speech that I haven't got with me and working out what's going on and just making sure family are happy and worrying about my new husband and just enjoying it. I don't want to be worrying about what's going on with loo roll and stuff over here and other puddings coming out.
People
now
having
where's
the wrong
the wine
food.
And
I mean, it is wonderful to be part of someone's wedding in that capacity. And, you know, people do really appreciate it and people know that you're the point person. But crumbs, you are busy all day. And I did get a level of satisfaction at your sister's wedding when I was on the bus going from the church to the venue and I saw you carrying all the flowers from the church on your own into your car to then obviously drive to the venue because you effectively had the same road as me at your sister's. And I was like, payback. And you did come up to me and like, God, you have to work hard, don't you?
So I emceed my sister's wedding and actually I was the point person for their venue. And their venue was also very good, but the lady was quite new in the role and also very sure that she wanted to do this. But I also knew that the way she was going to do it was going to cause problems with Mum or Hayley or, you know, not quite being in the time frame that we knew. Also, she was a bit pushy on time, which I thought was quite interesting from the venue's perspective. But that's by the by. You do realise that actually you need that sort of someone who knows what the couple want, because it adds to just ensuring it goes smoothly and it goes to what they want it to be, and it could be everything they wanted to be and planned without them having to worry about it being that.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole point of having, you know, your wedding party around you. The reason you have a best man, ushers, bridesmaids, is so that responsibility on the day can be elsewhere. Obviously, you didn't have any bridesmaids, but, you know, that...
We had a lot of ushers.
You had a lot of ushers. I do remember one of my favourite moments of the day is, obviously, I'd met all of your ushers before, and I'd met a couple of Tom's friends, but I don't think they really knew me. And I said, OK, then, we'll be meeting at 1100 hours at this door, and we're going to go through everything that's going to happen during the day.
Yeah, but there's a difference, there's a difference, Sarah, between being a chief usher and being you. And having your professional eye you bring to everything and sort of, you know, going around and thinking, right, and then this is going to happen and this is going to happen. I need you to do this and you and this are going to do this. That's much more like event management, which ushers have never had.
No, well, that's because especially most ushers are terrible.
Especially with guys who are from, you know, finance or politics or lobbying.
It is a pet peeve of mine that you turn up to a wedding.
Is it? The usher, you've never mentioned it.
And the usher hasn't got a clue what they're doing. And I do remember one of the ushers kind of going up to Tom and being like, why is this girl telling us what to do? I don't understand. What are we meant to do? And Tom went, oh, no, you listen to Sarah. She is in charge
also,
of you lot.
Isn't it just easier to just do as you tell us to do?
Well, I would say so.
And I think in hindsight, we probably should have got you all together so that we knew that was going to happen. We should have probably been clearer that was what was going to happen. But it's really reassuring to know that that's happening. That, you know, the little things, the confetti for the tunnel and the pictures and getting people in line and the handing of the orders of service and getting people sat is going to happen because we weren't in the room for any of that.
But also, I think what I find very frustrating when I go to a wedding and you speak to the usher and they don't ask you who you are, so therefore they don't tell you any information. And I'm thinking in my mind, I know that my friend will want me to be sat quite near the front. Because I'm a close friend.
But you also like to sit near the front, so you'd have been there and reserved a seat.
I mean, I do arrive at least an hour early for most weddings.
Yeah, you love a wedding.
Well, I like to be able to choose a good seat. I like to be able to see the bride arrive, but I also like to be able to see the groom turn round.
Just sit on the end of a row.
I know, but sometimes because of the pillars in churches, you've got to choose which is the best
row. I think
you've
overthought this.
I haven't. I've been to enough weddings where I know the best way to enjoy it. So when I went to your sister's wedding, people kept asking me to move along and I kept standing up and letting them into the pew because I had bagged a really good vantage point.
Making friends early.
But look, I had a very nice day. If those people were disappointed, they should have got there earlier, is my general view.
And there should have been lots of people who got to that wedding earlier, but that's the... Edit that out.
Is that not allowed?
So there we have it, Elliot's wedding. It was a really, really special day and it was really fun being the director of guest experience / chief usher, if not somewhat exhausting. And it truthfully has provided a lot of inspiration for some of my comedy. What was interesting with Elliot organising his wedding, though, is he is an event planner, well, to a certain degree, with his job. Therefore, he was really on top of logistics, dealing with the venue. But I think because they're both quite extravagant people, having a really common sense brain like me in the mix was quite helpful to stop them basically doing really, really crazy shit. But I think it all ended up quite nicely, especially dealing with a venue like Elmore Court, who just were really relaxed and really helpful. And I think, you know, make sure when you're planning your venue, see what the staff are like there. If they're not helpful, go somewhere else. You're going to have a lot of dealings with them, and they will at times be the make or break of whether you enjoy your day or not. And again, don't be frightened to ask your friends to do things on the wedding day. Like, I didn't really have much to drink until the speeches were over, and that's okay. You've been asked to do quite an important job, so don't shy away from asking your friends to actually do some really constructive things on the day. Anyway, I hope that you've enjoyed this episode. Please do follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Wedding Guest Pod. You can also visit our website where there's more information about Elliot's day, some lovely pictures and a bit more advice. That's weddingguestextraordinaire.com. If you've got any questions or tips that you'd like to ask about, please do send me an email, sarah@weddingguestextraordinaire.com, or indeed do get in touch via social media. Please do rate and review the podcast. It helps other people find it. And do listen in next week. Anyway, I'm Sarah Southern, your wedding guest extraordinaire. Do take care.